This is the January 18, 2018 environmental practicum class. We've just gone over mechanics of assigning projects, and we're getting started. So how about this? Taylor, I'll go ahead and do a revised version of this probably by tomorrow.
Okay.
So before people start swapping, make sure you're swapping with someone who actually is in this class. And we'll get it set out. Also, please just expect chaos. We have guest speakers every week, and I always have people cancel. I have people who show up unexpectedly who want to talk. My hope is we'll get one of the TCEQ commissioners to come in, and if he wants to talk, we're going to do it. We'll make it happen. I'll tell someone else I'll have to wait till next year. So if it causes you severe heartburn, let me know, but this is very much a fluid sort of living docket. All right? Okay, so with that, any questions? Oh, I guess there is one important question I want to talk about. Actually, two. Grading. No final exam, period. So 80% of your grade is your portfolio, 20% is just class participation. And frankly, class participation has never, ever been a problem in this class. People usually get engaged and jump in with both feet. Now, you do have a voluntary option if you want to, and I stress if you want to give me a self-assessment. You can just tell me, you know, where you think you were strong, where you thought you could improve, something that'd help me see clearly what you've done. And also, you can always, if you're doing a joint project, confidentially give me input on all your progress and what you did, but also what your partner did. Do not backstab, but again, that's never been a problem. If you ended up doing 90% of the work, it's fair to let me know. So that should be fairly straightforward. It means that, you know, come the end of April, you're free souls. You will not have to worry about anything for this class during final exams period. It also means some of you can just go ahead and graduate and having to sweat that too. Now, second, confidentiality. We'll talk about this more in a little bit, but I'm going to be asking you to act as clients and counselors. Anything you send me by email, anything you send to our guest/client by email, in this system is public record. And we'll talk a little bit about what's been happening lately, but please take that seriously. There's no reason on earth anyone walking down the street can't submit open records act request and see every single email, every single record that you've created on a university system going to a client. So I'm going to make sure that we designate things as confidential when we need to, and I may ask you to use Gmail or other alternative email systems that are not subject to open records act request. So if you have any concerns about that, if you have anything you want to flag for me that's a risk, please let me know. And I've tried to catch everything, but I'm human. Sometimes I miss it. All right? Okay. So with that, what I was hoping to do today is two things. One, I want to give you a sense of what's out there. What are your resources? Essentially, this is what I call informational practice. Basically, if a client wants to ask you a question, how do you go out there and find out what you need to know to be able to competently answer it? And that is a lot more than just being familiar with the specialized resources for environmental attorneys. It also means the power to create information. Then, second, and this may bleed over to a future class if time doesn't give us all the time we need to do this, I want to talk about rulemaking advocacy. That's really the entry-level thing that a lot of people do when they do environmental practice. What rules you spot, what rules you comment on, what rules you shape, what rules you kill. And that is effectively a whole separate mini practice. So with that, before we dive into substance, last chance. Questions, thoughts, concerns about class format, process, what the semester is holding for you. Okay. All righty then. What I'd like to do first is just basically give you a rundown of what environmental resources there are. I'm assuming everyone here is super competent, more than I am, about online databases, Westlaw, Lexis, what sorts of things you need for case law work, statutory research. So what I'm going to focus on is what's uniquely environmental. And what I'd suggest for you is that there's a whole ecosystem of informational resources dedicated solely for environmental practitioners. I'm going to yield the podium here in just a second to Katie to talk about what the library has, but I want to let you know in particular the sorts of things I looked at every day as a practitioner. Essentially, number one, and this sounds weird, the Federal Register. I actually used to get delivered in paper, plopping on my desk every single day. Federal law requires that any type of significant regulatory action by an agency must first be published in the Federal Register as a matter of public record. So as a result, now online, frequently, every single day I get an email with the table of contents for the Federal Register, and I check and see what agencies are doing in the environmental arena. I'm going to give you some examples of those in a second after Katie's done with her presentation. Number two, depending where you go, you're going to see these. Grab whatever you like. These are for y'all. Specialized environmental reporters. These are particular research materials that are generated on a daily or weekly basis for practitioners. The two leaders in the field are BNA Daily Environmental Report, which not only me, but I think virtually every major practitioner in the city gets a copy of it on their desk every morning. That's online, and you guys get it for free. The normal subscription price is, I think, over $6,000 a year. So take advantage of it while you can. It's under the Bloomberg Environmental Resources, which Katie will talk about with you for a second. The other one is Inside EPA, which is what's being handed out here. They do a whole host of different reporters. So Inside Superfund, Inside EPA, Clean Air Act Reporter. Not as universally read as the Daily Environment Report, but this one also is very good, particularly if you have a subject area that demands in-depth expertise. These are also extraordinarily expensive. They're also now moving more and more to e-distribution, but I get copies of them from sources that are barely legitimate. So you're welcome to copies of them, and I'll be glad to pass them out here. Now, with those in hand, I saw you'd like to sort of see them. I'm going to now step back and let Katie give you the bigger picture of what's available in the library, and then I'll dig in about how you can manipulate some of those resources once she's done.
Okay, great. Thank you, Professor Hester. I think the first time he did this class, my son had just been born, and now he's heading into kindergarten. So,
oh, wow.
My, how your class has grown.
It happens so fast.
Professor Hester has made life a little bit more difficult for me today. Well, actually, the ice and snow did. So I'm going to give you the 10-minute version of environmental law research and resources in what could easily be a whole class, what could easily be an entire course unto itself. Basically, just because of the huge breadth of law that environmental law encompasses. So my PowerPoint's over there. You'll see on Professor Hester's syllabus that a research guide, actually there are two research guides that we've created that I saw on your syllabus this morning.
I didn't update it, by chance.
I have not updated that guide. There's not too much.
It's not much that's happened, I was just curious.
Yeah.
Okay.
I looked at it today and decided I didn't have the time. But I'm gonna give you the quick version. You'll have your research guides. And of course I urge you to come visit me in my office with any questions or at the reference desk. I'm there every day. I'm there Sundays, so I'm easy to catch. So with that, let's go. Okay, so just to give you an idea of where environmental law comes from, of course, for regulations to be promulgated, you need an enabling act. And for agencies to be created, you need an enabling act. And these are just a few of the major environmental law statutes that environmental law encompasses. The National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, CERCLA, Endangered Species Act, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act, Marine Protection Research Statuaries Act, Sanctuaries Act of 1972, Oil Pollution Act, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, as you'll always hear it called, Safe Drinking Water Act, and the Toxic Substances Control Act. So just a couple of things. So with that, we have a large number of agencies that regulate and have the power to create regulations with regard to their respective areas. So, of course, you all think EPA, it's an obvious one. After that, we have Department of the Interior and also Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Indian Affairs, so on, Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Council on Environmental Quality, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Agency for Toxic Substances, OSHA, Department of Energy's Office of Energy Management, and the U.S. Justice Department Environmental and Natural Resources Division. So I think that's all of them last time I checked. So as Professor Hester mentioned, one thing he reads every day is the Federal Register. That, of course, is the daily edition of what's happening in all these agencies and in every agency in the federal government. If any of the agencies is going to have a new rule or going to change a rule, first it has to go in the Federal Register. We'll have our proposed rule, we'll have notice for comment, we'll have publication of the comments and the agency's comments in response, and eventually we'll get to a final rule. So I want to tell you the best way to find them here at the Law Center. Of course, they're available on the Federal Register websites. That's probably, if you just want to go there, that's the easiest. But for really researching the regulations, I recommend going to HINE Online. You'll see that in our drop-down of legal databases there. It's where you're going to find some of the other specialized environmental databases that Professor Hester mentioned. If you want to access this off-site, you need to be on the Law Library VPN. There's a separate file for the Law Library. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to IT and ask them to set it up on your laptop. That's the easiest way to do it. And then you'll be able to access it when you're off campus, or basically not on your laptop as well, because even sitting in this classroom, you won't be able to access the database without those files included. So again, go to IT for that. But once I'm on the legal database page, I can click down to HINE Online, and it will bring me to this page, which I know is really hard to see on the monitor here. But if you go to the page, you'll see there are a vast number of resources available. But what I'm concentrating on today is the Code of Federal Regulations, the CFR database, and the Federal Register Library. So you can read each day's issue of the Federal Register, of course. But one thing HINE Online does really well, it allows you to find sections and parts and sections affected. So here I've selected, I want to see 2016. I'm looking in hazardous waste disposal and disposal of coal combustion residuals from electric utilities. And immediately, as soon as I put in those, it shows me the changes from the CFR section I've selected. So it'll show me what's happened in the Federal Register in the last year that may have changed any of the rules or regulations that I'm examining. Of course, this is always a huge thing for practitioners. You always want to be looking at current law. If you're not looking at the current law, you're not being a great lawyer for your client. So you always want to look at sections and changes. So here I can see I have a couple proposed rules that looks like they led to the final rule. And so I can see the final rule as it appears in the Federal Register simply by clicking on the link, and it will show me the changes that have been made in that particular area. So it does that automatically for you, which most other services do not. And I think it does it in the most transparent way, where it's easy for you to see the parts, how it all works together, and to get the most recent information. Now, other than that, agency websites are going to be a huge part of your research component. On all of the agency websites, you will find laws, regulations, and then in the more specialized area, you'll find policy guidance documents that the agency has adopted that gives guidance to the implementation of the regulations. You'll find compliance memos. It issues on compliance memos on compliance issues, and even databases of where enforcement actions have occurred for you to research. And this covers all the different areas of environmental law. So we have policy guidance, compliance, enforcement, and data. So here's an example of a policy guidance document available on the EPA's website. It explains what the purpose of the document is. And here it is land disposal restrictions. And there, kind of in a more plain English way, says what the new regulations require. And these are stored on their website. You also have, one of my favorite things, is the agency data. All these agencies collect huge amounts of data from all over the country. It is required that all these industries give this data to the government at certain intervals. And so here we have up top the hazardous waste report. You can put in your zip code or your county, and you can see a perfect little Google map of where all the hazardous waste may be in your county. And in Harris County, there are some really surprising proximity to residential areas, schools, etc. I know Professor Hester knows quite a bit about this.
I'm demurring right now.
Yeah.
we'll get
into
that.
He gets quoted in the media from time to time on these issues, so I'd say so. But those are really, I don't know, fun is the word, interesting to look at, but they're great visual tools that they create with all the data. Another thing that has been a concern, I'm just sort of offside, but a lot of documentation and things are changing on these different websites with the new administration and changes within the EPA. So you can always use the Wayback Machine or the Internet Archive to go ahead and look for previous versions of the website to see if certain data might be available, or if you want to see how what the EPA is saying has changed from maybe 2012 to 2017, 2018.
Mind if I jump in?
Oh, sure.
She's being diplomatic. This is extraordinarily important. If you want to find data on a government website, particularly EPA, particularly related to climate change, it ain't there. It's gone. You'll find a website saying, this website's being updated. Please check back later. No access to it. So in addition to the Wayback Machine, there's also a separate initiative where law professors are trying to archive all deleted information and make it available. So if you're doing a project particularly related to a, say for example, clean air permit that imposes greenhouse gas emission limits, particularly for a coal-fired power plant, you're not going to find an EPA. You're going to do some additional digging.
Yes, so that can be an important part of your task as well. And who knows, that might lead to your Freedom of Information Act request and information creation, as Mr. Hester alluded to. Now, before I get into our secondary sources real quick, I want to talk about current litigation and court filings as they're important to environmental law research. The best database to use for this is Bloomberg Law, because they give you all of PACER for free. So essentially any document in all of the federal courts and a lot of the state and even district courts are now making all their filings available through PACER, which in turn Bloomberg is offsetting the cost for us to induce you to become a good customer of Bloomberg Law. But they really have the best docket search features. So one thing I do for some of my faculty members is I have keyword searches set up for certain events. I have music copyright and infringement for Professor Olivas and his law of rock and roll and all sorts of things. So every day I get like 30 emails from Bloomberg Law giving me updates on different cases and what's happening in them.
So if I asked you to do climate tort liability, you could keep track of all the new cases being filed?
Mm-hmm. Let me write it down so I don't forget.
This has been a worthwhile class just for that. Excellent. Thank you.
And in addition, I also cert if, for instance, if you have certain clients or in a certain industry and want to watch what other players in your industry are either suing or being sued for, you can track those as well. And just simple keyword searches. So you can get all of those documents immediately through Bloomberg, and court filings can be a wondrous source of information.
Is this limited to federal filings?
No, more and more of the state courts are joining in. So I actually have more luck than not when I'm searching for state court dockets these days. It gets better every year. Okay, the final thing I'm going to address is secondary sources. The research guide will have a lot more specifics on these specific databases. But a couple of our most used, the E&E Daily, which hosts GreenWire, ClimateWire, and a couple of others. This is really a current awareness service, so you know what is happening today in environmental law. Today, spurred by Trump, GOP shows love of earmarks. That is what is happening today in environmental law. And so you can read all of those articles. Again, you access that database through that drop-down menu I showed you before. Next, as Professor Hester mentioned, is the Environmental Law Reporter. And so that not only has all of your current awareness, topical issues, there's even a neat feature on here. If you go under For Professors, I don't think it's really just for professors, but it brings in a lot of the firm reports on certain issues going on in environmental law, if you want to see their expert analysis of what's going on in the field. It also has all your primary documents as well, if you want to search through there. Finally, I'm going to go to the BNA.
Can I jump in one second? This is optional, if you guys are interested, but the Environmental Law Institute, which produces that ELR reporter, actually also does a weekly email, which summarizes all the important activities and all the news reports from the law firms. The reason I want to flag it for you, and if you're interested, I'm glad to pass it to you, is they also include a listing of jobs posted nationally. So if you want to work for Sierra Club in San Francisco, if you want to work for the government in Indiana, it's one of the best places I've seen for sort of unannounced but available jobs in the environmental world. So let me know if you're interested. I'll be glad to send that over to you.
Okay, and finally, over on Bloomberg Law, that now owns BNA, one of the major legal publishers, they have their practice centers, and their Environment and Safety Practice Center, they've renamed it as the Environmental and Safety Practice Center. It houses all of their environment publications. And so you can have your, you not only have your laws and regulations, you have your federal agency documents, a selection of secondary sources, your news alerts, and also their own expert analysis that is very well regarded and used a lot. And really, these BNA publications are excellent for a number of topics, but I really recommend it for environmental law. So that is on Bloomberg Law, or you can access the individual databases through the drop-down on the Law Library website. Okay, that is my very quick tour of environmental law research. I will supplement that by saying, please come by my office or the reference desk anytime. I'm happy to help, happy to talk with you about all these things. I know previous students in this class have gotten a lot out of it, even further opportunities within the field. So I can say with great confidence that you're going to get a lot out of this course.
Thank you. All right. Ed, thank you as well for the presentation.
Thank you very much.
And will you be able to email me the mm-hmm. Or has it been updated or changed? Or I guess it has. It's been substantially truncated.
So yes.
All right.
Yeah, I'll send you the short version.
And I'll put it up on the website for everybody.
Okay. Thank you very much. And vote for your favorite chair. I think number 4 is in the link.
Now I want to go down and try out the chairs. Okay. So she gave a very great overview of the most important resources. So let me add a few other quick things. Number one, a lot of that stuff's heavily geared towards federal. So you're going to need to actually dig down and get separate state resources. The TCEQ website is particularly useful in that respect. I'll talk about that in a little bit. So with that in mind, I want to be respectful in the sense of that everyone in this room is coming with different degrees of experience and familiarity with environmental law. So at the risk of trying some folks' patience, I do want to make sure that we cover the basics as we go along before we jump into the advanced stuff. So for here, for now, the key thing I want to do is just remind everyone of the key statutes we care about for this class and the key actors we care about. Most of our work is going to be centered on two bodies of statutes. We're going to be dealing with a small constellation of federal statutes that drive the bulk of environmental law. Almost all of them share characteristics. They're old. Most of them were passed in the 1980s or 1990s, with one major exception. Most of them tend to be very, very complex, technically driven. So be prepared. I am confident at some point in the semester your eyes will glaze over as you're going through a particularly long-winded portion of the Resource Conservation Recovery Act and Hazardous Waste, the Clean Air Act. That's just part of the game. Hang in there. It does start to hang together after a while, especially as you start applying it. If I had to tell you the key statutes you're going to need to be familiar with, it'd be RCRA, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, the Federal Clean Air Act, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act, otherwise known as CERCLA, C-E-R-C-L-A, the Federal Clean Water Act, NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is responsible for environmental impact statement requirements, the Endangered Species Act, and last, TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act. Now, I don't mean to denigrate ones I didn't mention. We will talk, for example, about the Oil Pollution Act. We'll talk about the Community Right to Know Act. They're actually folded in some of the other statutes I've mentioned. Also, FIFRA, things like that, there are statutes that are very, very important, but in a sort of limited domain. FIFRA is the Federal Insecticide, Rodenticide, and Fungicide, Rodenticide Act. I hope I got all those right. Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide. There we go. It deals with basically things that are designed to kill things. It's poisons. So if you want, for example, to register a type of foam that kills fire ants, it's not TSCA, it's not CERCLA, it's not any of those statutes, it's going to be FIFRA. And FIFRA is a whole pocket universe to itself. We could do a whole class on FIFRA. I'm sparing you that delightful agony. So those are the key federal statutes. Every single one of those statutes has a corollary body of regulations that are at least 10 times as long as the statutes. Most of them embodied in either 40 Code of Federal Regulations, 40 CFR. You'll hear me refer to 40 CFR in every single class. The Clean Water Act regulations are going to be in 33 CFR. I will not ask you to learn or read those regulations except as necessary for your projects. But I want you to know that they're there and that they're important. Now, the thing I repeat in every class, I'll repeat it here and you'll hear it again, you commit malpractice if you don't include the states. That's especially true for environmental law. So our actors here, on the federal level, it's the Environmental Protection Agency, to a lesser extent, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for wetlands permitting. Also, you're going to be dealing with other specific agency actors as they get pulled in. So oftentimes, the Council for Environmental Quality, which oversees coordination of environmental impact statements. And you'll be dealing a lot with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which does biological opinions for endangered species. The interesting thing is that you have analogs for virtually every one of those in the state level. So you'll be dealing with the Texas Commission for Environmental Quality instead of EPA. If you're going to be dealing with wetlands issues, you might be dealing with the Coastal Coordination Council or the General Land Office, in addition to the federal U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. If you're dealing with the Endangered Species Act, you won't be dealing with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sometimes. You'll be dealing with, believe it or not, the Texas Comptroller, which has responsibility for endangered species in Texas. The key thing here is whenever I ask you to look at something and I only give you the federal, be sure to nudge me in the ribs and say, what about Texas or state requirements if it's in a different state? Now, I'm also being intentionally shorthanding a couple of other key things. I'm not talking at all about case law. That will be important, but I think we all know the case law issues that we don't really, I think, need to get into how the courts deal with environmental issues just yet. But I will say this. There's a whole separate set of administrative law, administrative judicial bodies, ALJs, administrative law judges. They're going to be housed at either EPA's Office of the Administrative Law Judges that are going to be either the Environmental Appeals Board or local ALJs. In Texas, you're going to be dealing with the State Office of Administrative Hearings, which has its own administrative law judges as well. So when you're looking at cases, don't forget you may be looking as well at administrative judgments in contested cases that are almost like litigation, and they'll have oftentimes the precedent you're looking for. Last, in terms of actors, the relationships between the federal government and the state. Key thing here is the federal government tends to drive the agenda. They set the baseline standards for most of these programs. Most statutes at the federal level, however, give states primacy on actually implementing them. In particular, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, all of those rely or give states the opportunity to take over the program. And so as a result, we have a Texas Clean Air Act. We have a Texas Solid Waste Disposal Act that meets all federal requirements at a minimum, but then can go beyond. That's particularly important in California, New Jersey, New York, and other states, which go substantially beyond. Texas tends to do what the federal law requires. It only goes beyond when there's unique Texas factors that require us to do more. So that means essentially there's a lot of friction. It's built into the system. It's designed to work that way. EPA or the federal government, other agencies will set a regulatory standard. If the state wants to take over delegation of the program, they have to keep up. So it's a running back and forth process. EPA will promulgate the rule. There's a certain window of time. Texas will have to update the rule. And if they don't like the update, they have to fight over what the rule must include. So you, as a practitioner, are oftentimes caught between the two. Now, beyond that, suppose it's not just a rule. Suppose, for example, EPA thinks Texas is dropping the ball on enforcement, that they're just refusing to take steps that are required by law. EPA claims it has the authority to do what's called overfiling. We'll talk about it more in a semester. But essentially, they can file their own enforcement action even when the state thinks there's nothing there. They can take over the enforcement action. So that tension is built into the system. One other layer between the federal and states that you need to know. EPA is not all run out of DC. Instead, we have regional offices. The regional office we care about most here in Houston is Region 6. It's headquartered in Dallas. They've just got a new regional administrator. They tend to be one of the most active, one of the most technologically sophisticated of the regions. Probably the only ones that come close are Region 9 in California, Region 4 in Atlanta, maybe Region 2 in New York. Key thing here is that if you're going to have a fight, you're oftentimes flying to Dallas before you fly to DC. And the people you talk to in Dallas know Texas through and through. So you have oftentimes a much better opportunity to shape and influence the way things need to be either prosecuted or dropped. So I'll pause here. Normally I would draw a complex diagram on the wall showing you how all the arrows interact with each other, but just big picture. Do you have a comfortable sense as to who the actors are nationally and here in Texas? Any questions about them? And out of curiosity, I know some of you actually interned at some of these groups. So. Okay. All right. I'll flag for later, just to let you know I haven't forgotten. I have not included the key enforcement agencies beyond the substantive regulatory agencies. So please don't think that we're overlooking DOJ. Please don't think we're overlooking the Texas Attorney General's office or the District Attorney or City Attorney's office. Those will come later in the semester. Right now we're focused on rulemaking and regulatory advocacy. All right, so with that, we have now about 20 to 25 minutes to cover two big topics. And basically, category one is informational practice. Category two is rulemaking practice. Informational practice really breaks down into two big baskets. Number one is just basically hunting gathering, finding information that you need to be able to persuasively influence the course of events. We've had a pretty good overview of the key databases and resources that Katie just gave us. Let me add a few others. Namely, there is an environmental databases that are not generally known to the public that you guys will find extraordinarily useful. In particular, if you go to EPA, there's a database that essentially is a database of databases. And the idea is that it will help you collect all the information into one place. So EnviroFacts is probably the one that gets the most use. It's a good starting point. What I would suggest is that if you get a client who has an issue or they're concerned about someone else's facility, your first step is to find out what permits they have using EnviroFacts. And usually that database will also let you find out what they emit and how they emit it. So you can find out what sort of environmental issues they should have. It has a mapping function so that you can actually see where this facility is and who's next to it and what it might be impacting, what water bodies run beside it. So at some point, I'm pretty sure each of you will need to pull up a profile of the facility to find out what permits and emissions impacts it's having on the local area. Beyond that, that's at the federal level. At the federal level, the only other databases I want to flag for you is ECHO, the Enforcement Compliance History online database. It essentially is a snapshot of all the trouble facilities have gotten into in the past. So if they've had a hazardous waste violation, if they've had a consent decree, if they've had a penalty they've had to pay, you can find out just how good or bad they've been. And that's invaluable in terms of finding out where their weak spots are or where your client's weak spots need to be covered up. That's a bad way to put that. Need to be strengthened. All right, that really thoroughly derailed me there. In addition, I will also say increasingly, and we'll talk about this when Matt Tejada from EPA Office of Environmental Justice comes, there is an environmental justice database, which will tell you to what extent your facility threatens vulnerable populations. If you're in a community of color, if you're in a lower socioeconomic status community, the rules are different. That's just the honest truth. Your facility is going to get higher scrutiny. EPA is going to be more likely to inspect it. Your penalties will be larger. Your prospects of criminal prosecution are higher. So it's well worth getting your EJ score for a facility as well. So those are the three federally that I'd suggest to you for right now. On the state level, there are similar databases available online, particularly with the TCEQ. There are only two I'll mention to you right now. You can actually go on, and there is a comprehensive index online at TCEQ for all permits at particular facilities. You'll need at least a name, or you'll need at least a permit number, or an address. You will find it a frustrating experience. It is a great resource for identifying what permits are there. It's terrible at telling you what the permits actually say. So you may find yourself identifying a permit and then having to schlep down to the regional office here in Houston to actually get a copy of the permit, or even go to Austin. Second, and this one's harder to get, but you can also get inside the office doors, STEERS, STEERS. This is the database everyone has to report to when they spill something or emit something. This essentially is the online database tracking all hazardous waste emissions and shipments. So it's harder to get to. You can't routinely access it online, but if you actually go to the offices, you can actually get a snapshot as to what this facility is doing. So that's sort of what's there. It's what's lying on the ground. It's information you collect, massage, organize. I'll pause here. You will have on the website a short list of environmental databases that summarizes some of this information that you can access. So I'll give you a start. It's online, so I didn't print out copies for everybody, but I just thought you'd like to be able to take a look at it so you can recognize it. Number two, assume that you look at the database and it doesn't have what you're looking for. Well, you could give up, go home, and open a beer. Or what we'll do in this class is you make the information, you create it. There are two ways you can go about this. If we're at EPA, or a government agency, we have the capacity to make people give us information or to create information. So what I have done is a bit of a preview of things we'll talk about later in the semester when we get to Superfund and to enforcement issues. But EPA has a capacity to issue what are called information requests. They can be under multiple statutes, in particular under CERCLA, Section 104E, RCRA, Section 3007, and under, you can also get information requests also under the Clean Water Act. I'm blanking on the name of the provision right now. The key thing there is that essentially EPA can require a facility to yield information it already has in hand. Also, in limited circumstances, they can make you create new information. So why am I telling you this now? You will likely be in a situation you're going to have to answer 104E requests. It's an informational practice, but from the other side. Now, for now, I'll just simply say there you need to be finely sensitive to the implications of the information request. They may be asking you for enforcement purposes what you've admitted. Essentially, it's a free subpoena. You'll know. You take a look at it, and it's a CERCLA 104E information request. They're asking what waste you shipped where and how and when and with who. That's basically building their record for them to come and prosecute, to enforce against you. That creates a whole framework of how you answer those, because essentially it's a defensive practice. You push back. You craft your answer accordingly. And we'll talk about those when we get to civil enforcement later. The broader one I wanted to alert you to, though, is you can have programmatic information requests. They just want a snapshot. They want to know what everyone is doing. For example, there was an information request asking all methane data from oil and gas upstream facilities that EPA issued as a prelude to imposing emission limits through permits. The Trump administration has withdrawn that information request. And it was one of the highest priority items for the American Petroleum Institute to get that information request killed. Because without the information, the rule can't move ahead. So this rule information practice is actually foundational in terms of rulemaking practice. I'll pause here. Any questions so far? I know I'm throwing a lot at you very quickly, but you're kind of getting a class at double speed today. All right? So that's information requests that you get thrown at you or that you may want to try and access online. Let me now get to the point where we're going to do in class, which is FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request. That is the primary tool used to get federal information that's available in a broad open parameters. Essentially, it's a federal statute. It's about 40 plus years old at this point. It gives everyone in this room, it gives everyone in the United States, an untrammeled right to request information held by the federal government, period. So essentially, you don't need standing. You don't need a reason. You don't need to have any justification. You just simply can say, give me a copy, and the federal government by statute must give it to you. So as you might imagine, FOIA is an enormously powerful instrument for environmental practice. Essentially, if you want to know what EPA is thinking, you FOIA it. And you can essentially create your own early warning radar as to what's developing inside the agency. So to do that, you have to be aware of a few things. Number one, there are exceptions. Not surprisingly. I once spent 3 years fighting over whether or not the FBI had to give me information that might ultimately identify a confidential informant. They weren't going to do it. So the key exceptions you need to know about, law enforcement. In particular, it's called the B6, B7 exception. If there's an ongoing pending enforcement action, the federal government has an exemption under FOIA to not tell you what they're doing. In addition, you also have an extraordinarily broad exemption for confidential informants. They are very aggressively protected by the statute. You also cannot get things dealing with personnel matters, why someone got fired. That's just not what FOIA is all about. You also cannot use it to get internal agency just memoranda, just correspondence to each other back and forth, interagency memos. Now, beyond that, interestingly enough, there are two other areas that have popped up more and more that I want to flag you to because you'll probably trip over them at some point this semester. FOIA cannot be used to get trade secrets, or actually confidential business information, more precisely. Now, that only works if the company or person who gave the information labels it as CBI. If they don't, it's yours. But if they do, and EPA gives it to you, it's a criminal offense. So they take CBI very seriously. They actually maintain separate locked files, physically locked files, because of that. You can fight a CBI designation, but you have to go to court, basically. We can talk about that court process in a second. Last, beyond CBI, confidential business information, the other thing that is specifically protected by the statute, geophysical information, well borings. Apparently, there were FOIA requests going to the U.S. Geologic Survey asking for governmental well bore logs to basically do free, cheap surveying to find oil deposits. That didn't go over very well with their competitors. So the statute, weirdly enough, carves out a specific exemption for that. Now, if you do a FOIA request and the government tells you to pound sand, which does happen, what do you do? There is an internal administrative appeals process, but most importantly, ultimately, you end up filing a lawsuit. On the website, I've actually posted a couple of things. Number one, this is a complaint. It's online, so I didn't print a whole bunch of copies again, of a FOIA request denial that someone wanted to challenge. Also, I talked a little bit earlier, here's a Section 104E information request to give a flavor of how those work under Superfund. So essentially, most of these lawsuits tend to be filed in the DC District Court, because that's where the federal agencies are, that's where the records tend to be. You tend to end up in lawsuits where if it's confidential information that's being challenged, having a very weird practice. Essentially, a large part of it is judge-driven, non-jury, in-camera review. The agency gives you a redacted version of the document, and then they get to sit in private with the judge off the record and explain why it shouldn't be disclosed. So What does that mean? It means it's really hard to win these cases. But you can't. You just need to be able to aggressively pursue it and expect it will take years and years sometimes. Bottom line, though, FOIA is probably one of the most effective tools you'll have as a practitioner to force the government to tell you what's going on, and frankly, sometimes to shift government activity. I'll tell you there are a few things that an in-house lawyer at an agency hates more than a FOIA request. They just don't want to get them. If you tell them you're about to submit a FOIA request, oftentimes they'll say, whoa, 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 don't do that. Please don't do that. I'll give you what you want, just don't send me a FOIA request. And you negotiate. Oftentimes, if you submit a FOIA request, you'll negotiate anyway. They'll call you and say, are you crazy? Do you really want this? I'll have to get an 18-wheeler to get the information to you. So you can end up doing things that give you what you want in a tailored way. So adjust the scope of your request. There are a couple of things you can do that make your FOIA request much more likely to be answered. And you'll probably use them in the projects we'll talk about in a second. Number one, agree to look at it yourself. Don't make them copy it. Don't make them scan it. Don't make them send you a giant email. If the information's sitting in an office somewhere, tell them you'll walk over there, look through it, and tell them which parts you actually want. And oftentimes that'll be the way to break a logjam. Now that may involve you flying to Dallas. It may involve you having to spend some quality time in a windowless basement office somewhere in the EPA headquarters. But nonetheless, it has been a godsend in some other cases I've worked on. And number two, offer to pay. A lot of times the agency doesn't want to do it because they don't want to incur the cost of doing it. So if you tell them up front, hey, I'll pay up to $500 to get this information, that prospective authorization frees them up to actually send you the information. So all my requests, all my FOIA documents tend to say automatically that we'll pay those kinds of costs. So with that, any questions so far? Okay. Never forget the states. There's a separate Texas statute that parallels FOIA. Open Records Act is what it's typically referred to, but bottom line is that it gives you the capacity to request the same sorts of documents from state agencies. For now, we're going to focus on FOIA because most of the projects we're working on this class, for at least initially, are going to be federally driven. So what I'd like to do is a couple of things. First, here's a sample information request. It's online as well, but this one was important enough I make copies for everybody, so feel free to grab one. This is just a template. It's a sort of sample letter that we would send every day at whatever law firm I was at to force the disclosure of information our clients needed. A couple of things. This is really old school. Most FOIA requests are online now, and there's a website on the class webpage. There's a link to the government's FOIA website where you can just basically type up a form and submit it directly that way. Call me hidebound. I think it's harder for the agency to ignore a request that's submitted in physical form. So what I tend to do is both. I'll do an online request and then follow up with a written signed request on firm letterhead. It tends to get more attention. In addition, once you've gone through this process and submit it, the wheels start to turn and there are certain things the agency must do that you can take advantage of. They have to answer in 10 days. That's required by the statute. Now, your answer will consist of a postcard saying, we've received your request and we're processing it. Not very helpful. But nonetheless, if they don't, you've got a way to push them. Number two, that request, that response will tell you who's handling your request. Call them. Pick up the phone. Reach out to them. Interact with them directly. You will find it is usually an attorney. You will find it is usually an attorney who's got much better things to do. And they are going to be highly motivated to get this thing solved and off their desk. So you can find a cooperative partner there, even if they're not perhaps a happy partner. Then once the 10-day response comes in, they usually are supposed to answer fully within 90 days. So I'm asking folks, and we'll talk about in a second in this class, to submit FOIA requests in the hopes that we might actually get answers by the end of the semester. Having said that, I sadly acknowledge the odds are low. The agencies, in particular EPA, are terrible about meeting the 90-day deadlines. So you can push them, but there's no real way, short of a lawsuit, to hold their feet to the fire. So just go in with realistic expectations. If we all submit FOIA requests, I expect maybe a third of you will get an answer by the end of the semester. Some of you may get one within 6 weeks, just because it's easy and on hand. Other people, you may never get an answer. It's just the way it works. So with that, any questions so far before I start talking about our projects, which I'd like for us to do? Okay. If you look at the chart, you will notice that I have, as the first lines of rows, projects for each of you to submit FOIA requests. These are suggested topics, which I think would yield useful information in a realistic time frame that actually are important data. For example, number one, a FOIA request from a rule that the Chemical Safety Board is trying to pull together that's going to require facilities that blow up to report what they've released. This rule is actually the subject of a lawsuit that just got filed because the CSB has not acted. A FOIA request would be a delightful way to create all sorts of attention and trouble and find out what's going on. So I'll also simply say that there are strong criminal implications on those reports and data. So it's useful to see who's reported and why. So James, if you pull that one and you don't swap it with someone else, I would suggest some things we can do to make it less likely to get objected to, such as the time frame we want the information for and what sort of fields we want from the data so we're not getting confidential or enforcement information. But if you look through, each of these has something like this. You will find, for example, the border wall is currently designated to go through a natural wildlife refuge down near Brownsville. The government is not saying a word about what exactly is going to be going through, where it's going to go, how it's going to be built, what damages it's going to do. They're claiming a waiver from all those requirements. I'd like a FOIA request to see what the hell they're doing. Excuse me, for anyone listening in the future, what the heck they're doing. So all of these projects are like that. I'm not proposing these just because of academic interest. They all have real-world enforcement or litigation implications, and they're all things that companies or agencies or NGOs will care about what you find out when you walk out of this classroom. So what I would like for each of you to do is take a look, ruminate, pull up the online FOIA form, take a look at the sample I've given you, and think about how you would couch a request to go to an agency to get the data you're looking for. There is no downside to requesting information. They don't hold it against you. You don't get penalized for it. It doesn't put you in the box, penalty box. So why not? It's also a good way for you to sort of get a sense of how to communicate with agencies. Given the fact that we have lost a day and that this is an accelerated class, and I've now left 4 minutes to go through rulemaking advocacy, which just ain't going to happen, I would propose take a look, talk with me by email or by visiting with me. My office hours, by the way, are Wednesday afternoons anytime, but also any other time by appointment. And by Thursday of next week, have a draft pulled together that you can share with me and we can talk about what you want to try and do with it.
Did you say draft by Tuesday or Thursday?
Thursday. Full week. And I will sit, for those of you who are doppelgangers, for someone who's dropped the class, I'll try and get you designated pretty quickly here. Other than that, you'll notice on the upper right-hand box at the start of the table, alternative topics. If you're interested in, the topic I've given you is just boring beyond words and you can't stand it, these are two backups. So if you want to swap them out, just let me know. The internal circle assessment report, basically the, again, not to be political in the class, but I think it's widely acknowledged that while EPA under Scott Pruitt is rolling back on a lot of different fronts and removing regulations off the books, they're being very aggressive about pushing forward Superfund cleanups. And the reason they're doing it is based on an internal CERCLA assessment report that the agency did summer of this year. So actually, it's 2018, summer of last year. I'm still right 2017 on my papers. Anyway, there is no information about how that report was developed. None. Essentially, EPA has responded to press reports by saying, we did it all without any record. And frankly, the law folks find it unbelievable. To my knowledge, I don't think anyone's actually submitted a FOIA request targeting that information. And we may be in a unique position to get that information because, without naming names, rumor has it that someone from Houston is going to be heading up the Superfund office in the EPA headquarters. Someone who actually, if I play my cards right, will be speaking to you as a guest lecturer. So we may be able to get some of that information if you guys are interested. So it's not just a boring report. The other one is the endangered species assessment for the Texas High-Speed Rail Project. They're moving ahead with the high-speed rail project. We're going to have a high-speed rail between Dallas and Houston. And they are now starting the environmental impact statement for that. To my knowledge, I have no clue as to whether or not they've actually looked at what endangered species are affected by it. So if you ask for that information, you'll get a lot of attention. So that's another fun one. Again, these are backup topics. Let me know if you'd rather swap those out for the ones you've been assigned. Deep breath. I've been monologuing you for about 40 minutes. Any questions so far or things you'd like to kick around? Because I think I hate to do this to you, I'm probably going to kick rulemaking advocacy to our next lecture class with me, which would be Tuesday after next Tuesday. I may ask our guest lecturer, which would be Stephen Cook, and also Bakia Nelson, to just walk through what they would tell you, so you'll have at least some grounding on it, and then I'll fill in the gaps and add more materials to you Tuesday at a hopefully slower pace. I'll simply say that rulemaking advocacy is probably short only to regulatory compliance counseling, telling people what they have to do to comply with the law. It is the engine for most environmental law practices. You know, this, where most of the fights are in the rules, they're not over the courts. So it's worth paying attention to. With that, last chance. The weekend is calling. No?
I have one general question.
Of course.
I know last year you invited us from your staff class a couple times to some of these meetings. Are they rarely at lunchtime, or will that 1 o'clock time change?
It's usually driven by the speaker. If it's easier for them to do it during lunch. But okay. I will also say open invitation. If the class prefers to meet during lunch with a speaker, it's easier for me to get people down here during lunch hour, frankly. It also gives the flexibility to invite more people to listen in if they want to. So just give me a nudge if you have a particular class you'd have preferred during lunch or just more generally.
Okay.
Also, I nearly forgot. When I talked about grading, I meant to give you this. You're going to end up with portfolios of 3 projects. Each of those projects are going to have to be done in conjunction not only with your client, but also with me. And I will tell you, over the years, I tend to see the same things pop up in most of the drafts. So this is a gentle, constructive, helpful guide on the mistakes I keep seeing over and over again. But this is a suggestion that perhaps we've saved some time if you guys avoided them, and we could jump right to the substance of giving you the best possible projects. So this is online, but I thought you'd actually like a hard copy too. There we go. A lot of it's just good thinking and good writing. That's what it really comes down to. All right. Any other thoughts, questions, suggestions? All right. Then I'll finish up with a final postscript, which is there is a possibility that things may crop up where I'll be invited to do things, and my full hope is that if some of you are interested in joining me to do them, you're welcome to come along. So, for example, if I end up testifying before Congress again this semester, and we can get the school to pay for some of your airfare to go up, or the Inner Center to do it, and you'd like to, give me a heads up. If I'm going to end up going to Austin to deal with a contested case matter, or if there's a permit hearing here in Houston, I'll give you a heads up about it, but you're welcome to do it. I probably can take all of you, but hopefully there'll be enough opportunities that everyone gets a fair shot to do something like that. All I ask in return is that you let me know, and also give me a heads up if you know of something that's happening that you'd like to sort of have us insert ourselves into. I would not be at all surprised, for example, if there's going to be a major conference on the Ike Dyke happening this semester. And if that happens, we can be there. We can play a role in it. Just unfortunately, probably during your class hours, so I can't assign it. So with that, you're free souls. Go enjoy the weekend. Try and stay warm. I'll see you on Tuesday next week. Oh, I guess a final comment. If anyone decides that for reasons of many sorts that you are going to drop the class, just let me know. I won't mind. I will not take it personally. All I ask is that it gives me a chance to let other people on the wait list know so that we can make sure that those spaces get wasted. It sounds like that's not an issue this year because they are giving heads up to people, but in prior years...
The wait list does end now that this week has started.
Oh, so there's no more wait list?
The wait list is just you got to check at all times.
Yeah,
okay.
I was just stalking.
It's a good strategy. So just let me know if you decide. I'll understand completely, but I just want to make sure we get the word out to people who need to know. All right. And that.